And
welcome to the DDS Podcast Broadcast.
Hello, this is Emma.
This is Miles.
And this is Kim.
And you are listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford Tufts Freeform Radio.
Yay. Welcome to the DDS Podcast Broadcast. We're so excited to be here. Thanks to Emma, our amazing media equipment assistant, for helping us make this broadcast possible. And thanks to Hudson for letting us have this slot. During this hour, we're going to be sharing student podcasts that have been created with the support from the Digital Design Studio at Tisch Library. But before we get started, we wanted to share a little bit about our department, what we do, who the Digital Design Studio is, where we started. And so we have a little segment for you about the history of the DDS.
Ready?
Ready.
The Digital Design Studio, more commonly referred to as the DDS, is located inside Tisch Library on the third floor. I'm Kylie.
And I'm Kim. And Kylie and I have both been working at the DDS for about 8 years. The DDS is a creative space. We support scholarship in a variety of forms.
Think podcasts, posters, map projects, timelines, zines, video.
Our goal is to strengthen your relationship with media, visual design, and digital tools and methods, both as critic and creator. And we try to help you interrogate digital technology through just making things.
But before the DDS was known as the DDS, it was the Media Center, where faculty and students could check out VHS tapes and DVDs and watch them in a viewing area located where the studio is today.
Back then, students would need a place to watch the film in the library, and if a movie was on VHS, they would need a player and a TV to watch it on as well.
That's Miles. He's our colleague in the DDS and knows a lot about how the DDS has changed over the years.
There were little stations called Carols. Each one had its own TV. It was big news when the TVs went from CRTs to flat screens.
He's been working here since 2009. He also knows a ton about movies, so if you are ever looking to chat someone's ear off about a film, Miles is a good person to do that with.
I really like movies. I try to watch a movie every day. I used to have some friends, and at one point we got into a contest to see who could watch the most movies, and it got really, really serious. If someone was watching a movie in one room, you'd clock it, and people would come in and start, oh, how long ago did you start this? Can you restart it? It got turned into a whole thing. And since then, it's been a little bit of a obsessive thing.
We asked Miles if he could share a little bit about the history of the DDS since he's been working here for so long. And I think the history plays a huge role in understanding a little bit more about the space and where we come from. What was the next sort of big shift? You mentioned there was the shift from CRT monitors to flat screen. Woohoo! What were some other shifts that happened that you recall?
There were a few things. Around the time that the DDS came into existence, which was 2011, it coincided with the media department beginning to circulate some cameras and audio equipment from the same desk that movies went out from.
What instigated the circulation of cameras and audio?
It was largely student demand. There was a period of time where some video production technology was getting a lot more accessible in terms of affordability. Like, one of our most popular things that we loaned back then were these things called flip cameras, which you could do 720p recording, and then you could just plug that into your computer and immediately offload the footage. And it was, at the time, kind of a big deal because unless you had a bleeding edge iPhone, you still couldn't really shoot in HD on anything that wasn't, you know, camcorder sized.
In 2017, the media collection, which includes VHS tapes, DVDs, and Blu-rays, all moved down to the second floor, the main level of Tisch Library.
So we continued to provide dedicated viewing stations in the design studio in a reduced capacity. I think we had four when the studio opened in 2011. And then when the collection moved from the library third floor to the second floor, that's when we moved all our viewing stations, and the space up here became devoted entirely to computer workstations. But the main changes that we've added, things like large format printing and 3D printing, and the recording room was also part of the initial build out, but has sort of, I would say, evolved and improved pretty substantially since its first incarnation.
Before ending our conversation with Miles, we asked him if there was anything about the story of the DDS that might be overlooked, and he shared the following.
I think as far as what I find compelling and a story that might not be obvious to anyone who's using the library today because of how the landscape of film and media consumption has changed over the last 20 years, the collection that continues to be held in Tisch Library of film is substantial and will have a ton of things that you may or may not expect, and definitely has a lot of things that you've never heard of, and is a really impressive piece of media history.
TLDR, next time you walk by the media collection in Tisch Library, know that it's a part of the roots of where the DDS started.
And come check out the DDS. Third floor, Tisch Library.
Okay.
Great. Our next podcast was created for the course Mass Extinctions, which is under the Earth and Climate Sciences Department and taught by Noel Heim. This podcast was created by Leah Munoz, Jasmine Powell, and Hudson Fagan. Please enjoy Duck, How Birds Survived the Apocalypse.
The world is flying past you. You spread your wings as you soar above the humid forests in the land that is known today as China. Below you, the earth is ruled by animals that loom as high as 130 feet in the air, the dinosaurs. The year? 65 million BCE.
You successfully bring food back to your nest when suddenly an asteroid the size of Manhattan strikes the Earth. This event would shake the world for 32,000 years and lead to the loss of 75% of all life.
The dinosaurs, after a reign of over 160 million years, were reduced to mere fossils. But to you, and to all those that come after you, this event is just the beginning. The same asteroid that set the world on fire will set the diversification and evolution of modern birds ablaze.
Wow, you've been through a lot, and we're so glad you're here.
Jasmine, they're not actually words.
Oh, that's right. Okay, everyone, I'm Jasmine.
I'm Leah.
And I'm Hudson.
And this is Duck, How Birds Survived the Apocalypse. So, you may have heard somewhere along your elementary or middle school science career that birds are the closest living relatives to dinosaurs. You might have been left wondering how the seagull that picks up your leftovers at the beach is the great-great-great-grandchild of a T-Rex.
Yep. Birds evolved from theropods, which is the same clade, or group, of dinosaurs under which the Tyrannosaurus rex are classified. The question is, how?
We're going to unpack it all for you, but we're not doing it alone. We want to bring special attention to a paper published just last year by Jacob Burve of the University of Michigan and his team called Genome and Life History Evolution Link Bird Diversification to the End Cretaceous Mass Extinction.
Right. Burv's publication focuses on phylogenesis, a term you'll hear us use frequently. Leah, do you want to explain what that is?
Sure. Phylogenesis is the evolutionary development of a group of organisms or species. Burv's paper focuses on phylogenetic shifts during the Cretaceous-Paleogene transition, or KPG transition.
So the paper looks at how organisms evolved over the end Cretaceous mass extinction?
Exactly. Which brings us to the paper's methodology. Burv uses phylogenomic analysis to study bird diversification and changes in molecular evolution. Phylogenomic analysis combines the study of genomes with phylogenesis, what Leah just described to us. In this case, Burv studied nuclear and mitochondrial DNA sequence data from a large number of living bird species from 198 avian lineages.
Right. And using this data, Burv's team found that developmental mode and body mass were the traits with the strongest association to molecular shift. And one would think that traits reflecting dietary preference would be an indicator of molecular shift, but the paper basically deems this as unimportant. Mass and metabolic rate, though, do play a huge role in this paper.
Absolutely. There are important correlations between shifts in these traits and changes in molecular evolution in birds around the KPG boundary. Molecular shifts are associated with decreased body mass and increased altriciality.
Another big word.
Do not fear. I have the definition this time. Altriciality is when an animal hatches in a helpless state and parental care is needed for survival.
Okay, and we also know that dinosaurs are precocial, meaning they had an easier time surviving on their own after birth. So this shift is pretty significant.
So the relationship between molecular shifts and developmental mode doesn't consistently point towards precociality. Currently, there are still some precocial birds, like quails and turkeys.
In sum, we learned that increased altriciality or reduced body mass during the KPG extinction may have influenced genome evolution through population level and demographic processes.
All this aligns with something we've seen in other mass extinctions, the Lilliput effect. Hudson, you're up.
Okay. The Lilliput effect is a trend of smaller body sizes in animal groups that survive mass extinctions. This makes sense because smaller animals tend to need less resources, so they're better suited for environments post-extinction.
And that's the key. Survival wasn't just about making it through the disaster, but about how species adapted in the aftermath.
So in order to use modern DNA to understand ancient bird speciation, the study employed a novel stepwise approach using the Jonas algorithm to estimate shifts and molecular substitution parameters across the avian tree of life. This method allows the researchers to detect when the mode of molecular evolution changed. They focused on shifts in base composition as a proxy for avian genome architecture.
The analysis revealed 17 molecular model shifts on 12 phylogenetic edges, with 15 of these shifts occurring very close to the KPG boundary, within approximately 5 million years. This temporal clustering suggests that the mass extinction event was associated with a burst of genomic heterogeneity.
Bringing it all together, the researchers ultimately found that the KPG mass extinction had a profound impact on bird evolution, leading to significant diversification among surviving lineages. This diversification is linked to changes in genome evolution and life history strategies, suggesting that the mass extinction event created ecological opportunities that shaped the evolutionary paths of modern birds.
This article enhances our understanding of the end Cretaceous mass extinction by demonstrating how it shaped the evolutionary trajectories of modern birds. Through genomic and life history data analysis, the study reveals that the KPG event acted as both a bottleneck and an opportunity, wiping out many species while creating ecological niches for the survivors. This phenomenon forces us to fundamentally invert our perception of the term mass extinction. These events aren't only drivers of destruction, but catalysts for creation.
The research highlights how the extinction event triggered an adaptive radiation, leading to the rapid diversification of bird lineages that persisted. It also establishes a connection between genome evolution, such as changes in genome size and structure, and the ability of certain bird groups to thrive in a post-extinction world. Additionally, the study suggests that specific life history traits, including reproductive strategies and metabolic rates, may have influenced which lineages survived and later diversified.
More broadly, the findings reinforce the concept that mass extinctions, while devastating, serve as evolutionary catalysts by reshaping ecosystems and driving new patterns of biodiversity. By integrating genetic and ecological perspectives, this research provides a more comprehensive view of how life rebounds after a global catastrophe, offering valuable insights into the long-term impacts of extinction events on evolutionary history.
Now that we've covered this paper in depth, I think it's time to test our knowledge with a little game show, perhaps? Hit it!
From Science Gone Wild Studios, this is Duck, Duck, Don't Peck Me, the game show where we test your knowledge of evolution, extinction, and birds that survived the ultimate meteor problem. Is everyone ready?
Wait, don't we need contestants?
Don't worry, I got this.
Question 1. 66 million years ago, non-avian dinosaurs disappeared, but birds, being the scrappy little survivors they are, made it through. Scientists now think one key reason was A. They had tiny emergency asteroids of their own to throw back, B. Their ability to adapt quickly to different environments through evolution, C. Their ability to migrate, or D. They bribed the asteroid to hit someone else.
I think the answer is B.
Correct! Also, you don't need to do an accent. We can just pretend you're an audience member. Birds that could adapt to new environments, especially ones that weren't reliant on forests, had an edge. Who knew surviving a global apocalypse would require flexibility? It makes total sense.
Alright, next question. Sorry. After the mass extinction, bird genomes changed in surprising ways. Scientists found that this change was linked to A. Increased brain size and advanced vocalization abilities. B. An increase in reality TV among bird species. C. Shifts in developmental timing and body size. D. A dramatic change in feeding preferences.
I think the answer is C.
Correct! This study found that after the extinction, birds experienced rapid shifts in their development and body size because, like we said, smaller, faster-growing species had an evolutionary advantage.
Okay, final question. Scientists believe that birds today are direct descendants of a particular group of dinosaurs. Which one? A. The T-Rex, which explains why geese are so mean. B. The Brontosaurus, which explains why ostriches are so tall. C. Pterodactyls, because they had wings. Or D. Theropods, a group of bipedal dinosaurs that includes velociraptors.
A. I think the answer is T-Rex.
That's incorrect. While T-Rex belonged to the theropod group, birds evolved from smaller feathered theropods, not the massive T-Rex. So it's more accurate to say D, theropods.
And that's our show. We'll see you next time on...
Duck, Duck, Don't Peck Me!
Up next is a podcast created for the Half the History Project, led by Jennifer Burton and Julie Dobrow. The project aims to curate, archive, and disseminate diverse women's stories through short-form biography, film, and podcasts. This episode on Ellen Garrison was written by student Chloe Courtney Bull and produced by the project's team and student Lillian McKeever.
Would you like to do our PSA before we get in?
Oh, I would love to. Listen up. Next month is May, and May is National Bike Month, and the third week of May is Bike to Work Week. It's an excellent time of the year to try this healthful, non-polluting way to travel. Cycling can be fun, healthy, and enjoyable, but it's important to follow the rules of the road. A motorist passing a bicycle must wait until it's safe to pass, then give adequate clearance. A cyclist should try to make it easy for a motorist to pass, but only if it is safe. When it is not safe to allow a car to pass, a cyclist should use the full lane. No matter what, watch out for distracted drivers, because they're everywhere. Cyclists have the same rights and the same responsibilities as other drivers. Drive your bike like the vehicle that it is, and every week can be Bike to Work Week. A message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio.
Mm-hmm. The town of Concord, Massachusetts is known for many things. You might associate it with the shot heard round the world, one of the opening engagements of the American Revolution in 1775. Or you might picture the charming cottage and verdant landscapes of Louisa May Alcott's Little Women. You might remember that it incubated some of the most revered American writers and thinkers of the 19th century Transcendentalist movement, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, William Ellery Channing, great men whose legacies echo through history. Concord was the birthplace of many trailblazers, but history has remembered only a select few.
Hi, I'm Nikki Turpin, president of Robbins House in Concord, Massachusetts.
The Robbins House was the childhood home of a young woman who would grow up to become a trailblazer in her own right. Today, the Robbins House is a museum of African American history.
Concord's a very white town, and it's not a brand new thing. That's just how Concord was. But it's also the place where the revolution started. And so I think that it's in the water, the land of Concord, to be revolutionary and to make changes happen. If you're that revolutionary, why is it not also within your bones and like in your blood to say, I'm going to also talk about the brown and black people who lived in this space? Ellen Garrison was a civil rights activist and educator who grew up in Concord, Massachusetts.
Ellen lived in Concord at the same time as Emerson, Thoreau, and Channing. We remember their names. It's only more recently that people have learned Ellen's. She was a black woman, the daughter of a formerly enslaved man. She became an activist for racial equality as a young girl and dedicated her life to educating other African Americans and advocating for civil rights.
My name is Bob Gross, and I'm James L. and Shirley A. Draper, Professor of Early American History Emeritus at the University of Connecticut.
In 2021, Gross published The Transcendentalists and Their World, a book about the history of Concord. Part of his research touched on an unusual organization, the Concord Female Anti-Slavery Society, a group dedicated to furthering the cause of abolition. The members were young and old and had different levels of education and economic security. The group contained some women whose last names are familiar because of the associations of their more famous husbands, sons, or brothers, like Lydian Jackson Emerson and Cynthia Dunbar Thoreau. Ellen's mother, Susan, was also a member.
Susan Robbins Garrison, a black woman, joins as a founding member with an overwhelmingly otherwise all-white group of women. That's important in non-tokenism. In part because there were so few black families in town and black women to join, but also because it was key to the new abolitionists that had fought not only to end slavery in the South, but also to push for equal rights and equal citizenship in the North. And so Susan Garrison, here she is, the daughter of a formerly enslaved man, Caesar Robbins, and the wife of a fugitive slave, Jack Garrison. Her joining brings out strongly how much the Concord group wanted to align itself with pursuit of equal rights and equal citizenship, as well as against slavery.
Like her mother, Ellen Garrison would become an anti-slavery and equal rights activist. Growing up, she was the only black student at her school. In 1835, when Ellen was 12 years old, Concord held a big parade to mark its bicentennial.
When Concord as a town celebrated its bicentennial, all the children and other luminaries in town, including people like Ralph Waldo Emerson, were marching in the parade.
That's Jen Turner, executive director of the Robbins House.
So Ellen Garrison told her teacher that she would not march in the parade, that her mother had forbidden her to do that because she had been crowded out the last time she had participated in a parade. And she said, no one would walk with me anyway. So at that point, Abba Prescott, who was a little bit younger than Ellen, stood up and said that she would walk with Ellen. The story goes that they walked hand in hand in the parade under the curious stares, and in many ways, angry stares of the spectators. Clearly, it must have had a really important experience for Ellen as a young girl. We think that it was one of the sort of early instances in her life that really helped pave the way for her as an educator and civil rights activist.
it shows that a young girl can stand up in the face of what she knows to be a lot of hostile neighbors, maybe even classmates, and do what she thinks is right. And it's a story of how not just Ellen Garrison, but Abba Prescott can stand up together. It's a story of young girls, their sisters for social justice. Ellen Garrison was curious. She wanted to know about a wider world. And she proved that when she moved to Boston and then to Newport, Rhode Island. She taught school and then she went to the South to teach the newly freed people in Maryland, in Virginia, in North Carolina. She said when she went to apply to teach in the South that she wanted to do something for her own people. And she proved it by devoting the rest of her life to the cause of education of Black people all across the country.
In April of 1866, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act, which was the first time in American history that civil rights had really been codified in the law for persons of color. In May of 1866, Ellen Garrison and a fellow teacher went to a train station in Baltimore to try to desegregate the ladies' waiting room to test whether the Civil Rights Act would essentially be upheld. The station master forcibly ejected her from the station, and she eventually sues in the state court in Maryland. And although her case was eventually thrown out, the station master was fined for his behavior in forcibly ejecting her. She really becomes one of the first, if not the first, person of color in the United States to really challenge segregation in this time period.
It's significant that Ellen Garrison's important story isn't more widely known, mostly relegated to footnotes in the history of a storied American town.
I think that the reason why her story isn't told is just because of the fact that she comes from a small community in Massachusetts, and it's taken a while for her story to really come to light. And so I think that even though she did something that was just as brave and just as historic as Rosa Parks' actions in Montgomery, sometimes these sort of hidden figures of history take a while for their story to come to full light.
These stories are so important because so often we don't hear about the person who was living their everyday life with a good mission and a good heart. We often think of just stories of Black excellence, so to speak, but there were so many people doing so many things to better the communities that they were around or wanted to be within. And that's white, Black, Latino, everyone, they're really trying. And so getting those stories heard of those quote unquote, the little people, the unheard people, getting their stories out allows their legacy to live on and hopefully inspires people to realize, you know, my name might not be remembered, but what I did will be remembered.
That was Ellen Garrison in Concord, The Time, the Place, the Person, from the Half the History Project. You can learn more about the Half the History Project at halfthehistory.org. Our final podcast for the afternoon comes from the Storytelling for Social Change class in the My Turn Reentry program. My Turn facilitates a trauma-informed approach to reentry through Tufts University coursework and a certificate in civic studies. My Turn is a part of the Tufts University Prison Initiative program. This episode was created by Jody Boykins, David Del Valle, Tiavi Melendez, and Naheem Washington.
From the greater Boston area, you are listening to the fifth season of the My Turn Conversations podcast, brought to you by the Tufts University Education and Reentry Network program, My Turn, told by people who have lived it and are working to overcome the odds.
I'm David Del Valle. I am 31 years old, and I am a junior at Tufts University. My hometown is Lowell, Massachusetts. It is a small town, like 30 minutes outside of Boston, with a lot of poverty, a huge Puerto Rican community, a huge Cambodian community. My neighborhood had a lot of gang violence between the Cambodians and Puerto Rican population. I grew up rough. My mother was a single mother. Father was incarcerated for most of my life, and I don't know. I never really saw myself coming to college, and my journey to Tufts was super unconventional. I was incarcerated serving a 10-year sentence, and thank God I met Dr. Hillary Binder 3 years into my sentence, and she kind of just brought me in, taught me about college, helped me educate myself, and kind of just rebuild myself and allow myself to get a chance at college. And yeah, that was how I got to Tufts, and I'm just grateful to be here, honestly.
Hi, my name is Naheem Washington. I'm from New Haven, Connecticut. New Haven's a small little town known for Yale University, but outside of Yale, New Haven's not such a good environment. I grew up around a lot of guns and drugs, and watching my cousins go in and out of jail. Luckily, me and my brother, we ended up in college, but we're one of the few that did end up in college, and our dad pushed us to make it out here and take out and not do the things he did. So I'm a senior going on graduating this May, and I'll be continuing my education and master's programs.
My name is Ciavi Melendez. I'm from Nevada, the Duck Valley Indian Reservation. My community is the most isolated community in the continental United States, with the nearest grocery store being 2 hours in any direction. We're surrounded by mountains and canyons. Up until COVID, our community didn't have cell towers. We only have a single grocery store, a deli, and a K-12 school with about 300 students. Our school, we have a higher dropout rate than graduation rate. Kindergarten, my class was originally 32 students, and we commenced with 10 graduating, and I was only one of two who are currently pursuing a higher education. And I went the farthest, all the way across the country. And my experience at Tufts has been out of this world, and I'm very thankful for it.
Hi, my name is Jody Boykins. I'm also 29 years old. I am from Lowell, Massachusetts as well. And a little bit about where I came from, we grew up with a culture of just perpetuating like ignorance and perpetuating like toxic masculinity, where you're not really allowed to be who you're supposed to be. You're kind of just living up to the impressions that are around you at the time. So it forced me to kind of like become somebody I wasn't and just hang around like a lot of just nonsensical people, and not even that they were bad morally. But unfortunately, we were just so hurt by some of the things we've experienced without any outlet that it led to even more violence and more anger. After a couple of losses and just years of the same things, I found myself in prison. And then I found Tuppet in 2022. I went to college for almost 2 years inside. And after I returned home, shortly after I got my associate's degree, started the MyTerm program, graduated the MyTerm program, and then found my way to be a matriculated student at Tufts University. And so, to say the least, my journey here was nothing short of just unordinary. I don't think a lot of people know how it feels to walk into a space and just automatically feel like you're not supposed to be there.
Being an unconventional student at Tufts has honestly, I don't know, enhanced my imposter syndrome sometimes and made me feel super insecure. Sometimes I feel like I dress a little bit more business casual just so I'm not like offending anybody or scaring anybody. Like, I'm already a 6 foot tall man of color with tattoos who came out of prison, and I don't know, I could feel the looks when I like wear jeans with some Jordans or a hoodie, and like, I don't know, I feel like people have treated me different when they see me like with a do-rag on and a hoodie, as opposed to like when I have my blazer on. I like, people kind of feel like I'm more approachable and I don't get any dirty looks or like awkward exchanges with people. And I don't know, sometimes I feel like I'm constantly trying to like code switch, and I don't want to feel like I'm losing myself and trying to be somebody that I'm not, but I also don't want to like offend anybody with my presence. And yeah, it's a tough thing to manage sometimes. Like, I'm still figuring it out, to be honest.
I kind of came to Tufts telling myself this is a place where I knew I wouldn't feel like I would belong, because it'd be filled with a lot of people that are not like me and the polar opposite of me. So coming in here with tattoos and all that, I kind of went to class my first few weeks covering up my tattoos, walking around dorms covering my tattoos, just because I didn't want to stand out more than I already stood out being Afro-Latino on a very white dominant campus. But then over time, it also kind of taught me embracing my differences and also showing how like what I went through or what I know put me ahead of my classmates. Everything I had to do independently for damn near my whole life. My classmates were just learning how to do. I did feel like I didn't belong, but over time, that feeling of not belonging became an empowerance and made me feel like I was ahead of the game rather than I didn't belong here. I was in a place where I was street smart and way more street smart and book smart compared to everyone who was just book smart around me. So I did feel like I didn't belong, but I felt like I was ahead of the game in a sense. So my imposter syndrome was kind of different, but it took me a chance. It took me a while to feel like I belong.
Similar to all you guys, my mom told me that I'm going to the East Coast for my education and not community. And it was something I realized really immediately when I got here. Most people have never met a Native person in their entire life, let alone on the East Coast. I didn't realize how different people's lives were, especially when it came to like their socioeconomic status and the things that I grew up thinking were normal, when most people have like fancy vacation homes and are like their first car was like a Bentley, and I'm over here and I'm like, I have like my one good basketball hoodie that I came with and like my pair of Jordans, and I'm also tatted. Tattoos are very common back home, but in the East Coast everyone just has these little tiny tattoos, and I'm over here with a half sleeve. I'm a freshman and I'm a girl too. Like it was a little awkward, and I didn't know what I could or couldn't say because I didn't want to almost like scare people, or like, but in a way I also didn't want their pity either. Like, I don't want their pity because I'm not also not ashamed of where I come from. I'm not ashamed. It's just that I didn't realize how untraditional a student like me really was at Tufts. But through Tuppett, I've been able to find community and be around people like me. I always say that I connect more with the My Turn students than I do like the average Tufts student. And when I'm in classes with the My Turn students, I see like I'm in a classroom with like my uncles, my brothers, my cousins, and it feels very familial, and it makes me feel comfortable being here at Tufts.
I remember I was 17 and I went on a tour of Tufts when I was still in high school, and we walked around, they did the whole show, they showed us everything, they showed us how we could live if we got accepted to the school, right? And then 2 days later, I'm fighting my cousins. And so the disconnect there was, yeah, it looked good. And then as soon as I went home, it's right back to reality, you know? And the barrier between me and higher ed was never my academic intelligence. It was never my ability to achieve. It was more or less the access to opportunity that was just not present. And to now find myself in that same institution, I just can't help but ever think, like, would I still be accepted if I didn't enter through My Turn or if I didn't enter through Tuppett? Because clearly I went on a tour 10 years ago. Why am I accepted now and not then, right? I mean, and it always makes me think like how we always have to just share our story and how some people get to choose what pieces of themselves they give to the outside world. And I have been home for 16 months now, and I cannot tell you how many times I've had to apologize. I can't tell you how many times I've had to explain my past. I can't tell you how many times I've had to live my worst decision over and over and over again just to fail like I'm accepted and to fail like I did good enough and to put that person at ease. It's really as simple as like when someone gets angry, they're just angry, right? They're showing emotion. But if I was to get angry, I'm violent, right? And so there's a huge disconnect there where we have to monitor the things that we say. We have to monitor the things that we wear. We have to monitor the people that we keep around us. And it's just, how do you expect anybody to ever feel like themselves if they are just always feeling like there is just this big, big, big microscope always looking at them?
It's tough, but pressure is a privilege. Yeah, Jody, you spoke a lot about like the pressure of what it means to be an unconventional student at Tufts, and yeah, that really resonated with me. I'm the first formerly incarcerated man to ever come to Tufts, and you don't know how many classes I had to get up and say that. I had to get up in front of the school on multiple speaking engagements and talk about my crime, and I don't know, I try to do it like willfully, because I don't ever want people to think like I'm hiding who I am or I'm ashamed of my background. But it's also like, how many other students got to come in and talk about the worst thing they ever did in their life? How many other students got to sit here and talk about their trauma in front of the whole school just so they could be accepted? When it's like they were already accepted when they got their acceptance letter. Like, they're not having to socially get approval everywhere they go and move a certain way and feel like you're walking on eggshells because you're around a bunch of people that might not accept you if you show up wearing the wrong clothes or if you say the wrong thing or if you're too cultural, if you're too black, if you're too Latino. So, like, I don't know, we don't want to offend anybody, but there's, like, a lot of pressure of also being that person from that walk of life. Because if I do good, now they're like, oh, other formerly incarcerated people can come here because, look, David did well. But now if I fail out or I offend somebody, I'm afraid that they might not let somebody else who's formerly incarcerated come to this school. I'm afraid that, like, people with tattoos or Puerto Rican people are going to be looked at differently based off my actions because I'm representing my whole group. I'm representing my whole ethnicity. My whole experience before here is, like, with me everywhere I go. And I feel like there's a lot of pressure from, like, everybody back home that I have to make it because there's another generation of kids, like, that come up under me that have hopes and dreams of going to higher ed, and I'm the only example that they have of somebody that's Puerto Rican, that's from the hood, that's been through the struggle, that actually made it here. So now I got to carry myself a certain way for those people as well.
Coming here, I had to, like, remind myself that I was at Tufts and I wasn't at home. There was a lot of instances where people would say something to me or touch me, and I would want to react like I would react like I was back home. And like you said, like, that reaction would be violence or saying things that I can't really say in an environment like Tufts. So I kind of had to take that adjustment period to recognize the way I would react back home isn't the same way I could react to certain things here at Tufts. And then also, I had to realize that I was also a leader to those people back home. But something that was difficult for me, a lot of people don't know what Tufts is back home. A lot of people just know I would go to college. So it's nothing about the title of the institution or nothing like that. It's just the fact that I go to school and the fact that I achieved an acceptance to higher ed. That's all that anyone back home cares about. But then that's the extra pressure of myself that I know Tufts is the university that it is, not to mess up while I'm here, and to also build a path for those behind me. Because I don't want to mess up, like David said, mess up, and then people that look like me don't get the chance like I got. And I kind of remind myself every day, is like, I'm not just doing this for me. I'm doing this for my friends, my brothers and sisters behind me who didn't have the chance or who are going to get the chance to do it. So there is a lot of pressure to not mess up, but pressures make diamonds. I like to say we're the diamonds in the rough, where we got the chance to make it through. And it's just now, what are we going to do with this chance to get back?
You all made really beautiful points. Similarly, I think, well, outside of school, I'm a substitute teacher at our local school. And something that I always talk about with, like, the younger students is how many opportunities I have been given because I went to Tufts specifically, like a nice PWI in the East Coast. By the time I graduate, I will have been able to study abroad in 3 different countries, something that I don't know anybody in my family who has studied abroad, and because we're at Tufts, we just have a lot more resources. And sometimes it's hard because, like, these kids, they're like, well, we just want to make it out of the res, but what does that mean? Like, I guess you go work, but an education provides you so much more opportunities. And I realized how even, like, the older people, let alone, like, the little kids, the older people are also looking up to me, and I feel like a pressure. Like, I've worked with, like, our tribal council and in meetings with them, with, like, lawyers when it comes to the extractive industries destroying our mountains. And they're like, well, this is Ziavi and she goes to Tufts and she's going to come back and she's going to be a lawyer and she's going to win these for us. And I'm, like, in there and I'm kind of nervous because I'm the only one doing it, but I have, like, a whole community depending on me to succeed, not just at Tufts, but even, like, multiple years after in law school. And then to keep on going, to just dedicate my life and my education to, like, helping my community. So I think it's so important that I'm here and to take space so I can create space for other Native students, specifically Native students that come from reservation communities, because we just have so little access to education.
Could not have spoken more beautifully, and I definitely want to bring it back to, like, something David said that really pinged something in my brain when he said pressure is a privilege. And it makes me think, because I said a little bit earlier about how the lens is always on us, like, there's always a microscope looking at us. However, like, through that, at first it was uncomfortable. At first we had to go through a lot of insecurities, but after working that, we realized they left us with a gift, and that's a gift to, like, look at ourselves before we look at the outside world. And so it's to hold ourselves accountable before we even enter a space to realize, like, we're owning every decision we make, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the beautiful. And so when you do that consistently, you just show up, and you realize that people start looking to you for advice. People start looking towards you because, like, you are just so in tune and you make sure your thoughts and your heart are one. And unfortunately, that is something that's very hard to do. And so it always brings me back to the more people trust you to get things done, the more stressful it's going to get. However, somebody initially trusted you to take care of that so-called thing that's stressing you out. And so it just signifies like a high level of trust that somebody put us in a position to turn a trauma into a changing force. And that also brings me back to what Siavi said about how we have to take space to make space. I definitely want to delve into that, of how we can just come out here and spend 3-4 years gaining all this knowledge, spreading this wisdom, gaining the wisdom, just sharing space with all these people. But then you take that and you bring it to where the opportunity does not exist, because every single one of us are from a place where maybe opportunity does exist, but it is at least 20 times harder than the average place of the person that is sitting next to us in these tough classrooms. And so to be able to like be a part of that, to be able to like gain that network and then bring that back to people that don't even know something like that exists, is something that words would never be able to explain how beautiful and powerful it could be.
Yeah, you guys both spoke about something that really reminded me of like this quote that this lawyer told me one day. He just walked to me and was like, "Hey, you go to Tufts, right? You're the formerly incarcerated kid, right?" And I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "The fact that you made it into that room with all those people who had a privileged background says something special about you. It says something special about people who come from a marginalized background, who come from an unconventional walk of life and make it to higher ed, that there's like an extra special strength in you, that you were able to overcome every hurdle they put in your way and still be sitting next to somebody that didn't go through that." And that just made me think of, I don't know, the importance of community and like having a sense of belonging in higher ed, which for people with an unconventional background, we don't normally get that. Like, we have to go out of our way to build community in here, and we don't always feel like we belong. And those two things are like super important, because I feel like the conventional students, they kind of have that. They come in, like, they might have had a parent or a cousin or an uncle, or they might have known a professor. Like, they have some in to, like, what does it mean to be a college student? Like, I'm first gen. My family didn't even graduate high school. Like, my mother or my father dropped out in middle school. So I don't even, like, have a reference of what it means to, like, have a sense of belonging at higher ed. And most of these people do, like, they know, oh, go to this club or go to this center and go talk to this person and they'll teach you how to navigate higher education. But I feel like I'm just navigating it blindly. And I'm grateful for like the Tufts University Prison Initiative and the My Turn program, because they welcome and they've created community and they've created space where formerly incarcerated and incarcerated students can just belong. And even if you don't have a club outside of here that you belong to, you know that you have a sense of belonging inside the Tufts program. I know that I'm lucky to have that at Tufts, because there's so many other colleges across the country that don't have programs like that for people who are formerly incarcerated. It's important to have a sense of community at college, because everybody's away from their family. It's important to feel like you belong there, because we're all having self-doubts. And that's just something that, like, where we're working on. And we're, like, I don't know, I think it goes back to, like, taking space to create space. But I think it's just, like, to, like, have the responsibility so that I'm creating more community, I'm creating more resources, I'm creating more sense of belonging, so that the formerly incarcerated student that comes after me has a easier time or has a bigger sense of belonging of being here.
For me, the sense of belonging in higher ed kind of was different. My mom, she had me when she was 18 in high school. She graduated valedictorian, got a full ride to college. So, like, every time I said something, my mom was like, "Well, I did it with you when I was 18. I went to college." I was kind of under the assumption that, like, no matter what I've ran into, that, like, I had to find a way to, like, break it through, because, like, my mom showed me, like, she did it with me and she went to college. It was like, even without belonging, you have to find a way to still make it through. So me being an athlete here, I kind of had my community the first 2 years just be like the track team. And that really wasn't healthy for me, because, you know, being at Tufts, not a lot of people have the same experience as me. So I really wasn't able to share a lot of things or express my true self. But it wasn't until, like, you obviously said, like, Tufts has so many great resources. So it wasn't until, like, I tapped into those resources and talked to, like, a couple of my advisors, and I was able to make a pre-orientation about my interests, and then that was like my first step of making a community of my own and seeing the friendships I was able to make and all that. But then it wasn't until this year, until I joined Tuppet and I was able to feel like I was back home in the kitchen with like my cousins, my uncles, and we're just kicking it. And I feel like since I joined this program and been part of the program, it re-energized my love for education and also sparked the this is why I'm doing it. And being part of this community at a place like Tufts has helped me see the importance of why I'm here and what I could do in my education, because I feel like if I just continued walking along the path, I would have just been another cog in the system just doing something rather than actually making a true difference. And now being part of this community, I feel empowered and also feel like I have a group of people that are like me that love higher ed and see the importance of higher ed that continue to push me. It's nice for me to have a community that has the same mindset and the same background as me in a community like Tufts.
I'm very fortunate to have learned about the Tuppet program really early on in my college career, my spring semester, and I didn't realize how big of an impact this program was going to have on the rest of my college career and into my future ambitions and goals. The close-knit communities and like the things we were learning about that affect the MyTurn students, it was really reflective for me because I was like, oh, this is me too. I didn't realize that it wasn't just healing for them, but it was also healing for me. And I fell so in love with this community and the program that I was like, how do I find a way to stay with them? And it took me so far. I created my own major just so I can hang out with all the Tuppet people, because this is where my family is on campus. And this is where I feel comfortable. And I know that a lot of the things I've learned, I've been able to take home and have had really meaningful conversations with my mom and my aunties about the criminal justice system, as my cousin brother and a lot of my relatives are currently inside. And it was very emotional, but it was very healing for my family to like know things that we didn't know about. Like, this is why the things are the way they are. And I was able to give that to them because of this program and because of the community here.
When I think about the importance of community in regards to how we found higher ed, I said it best, the family. I can't think about somebody that I lived with for almost 18 months before I came home, because I never believed in myself. Because when you make one choice that you lost time of your life for, you very much question every decision you make after that, because you don't want to make another choice that's going to take years away from your life again. And so you don't really think you're capable of anything because you're too busy trying to battle with the fact that I just don't want to make a wrong choice. But right and wrong is all dependent on the structures that we have been placed in. And so we never even got the ability to determine what was right or wrong within ourselves. And this man for almost 18 months just told me how smart I was. He told me how good I was. He told me all these great things I was going to do when I got released. And I thought he was lying the whole entire time. And so I had such a high level of respect for him that I listened. I just didn't believe him, right? And then when I came home, I found so many more people like that. I found David, I found Kentel, and now Lou, and then Siavi, and then Naheem, and then Juan, and just, I could go on forever, and it's just, there's always an air. And so when you kind of live the path that we live, some days are good, some days aren't so good, but they're all beautiful in the sense that even on those worst days, you have an air, you have a shoulder, you have a friend, you have a whole family of people that will listen to you, and not because they just want to patronize you or not because they want to pat themselves on the back that they did a good thing for somebody else. They care about you. And growing up in our culture, we're not really used to people that truly care. We're used to people that are like dealing with us with a specific motive or an agenda, or they're trying to get something accomplished, and like we are their route to do so. And so you're always kind of questioning somebody's intentions. But to just be around a whole bunch of people that, you know, if I do make a wrong choice, they're going to love me anyway, and you can give yourself to them wholeheartedly, that's something I've never experienced until my turn in higher ed in regards to the Tuppet program. And that's something I will do everything in my power to take with me wherever I go after.
I think we're all like creating a paradigm shift for higher education and really breaking this stereotype that people have in their mind that a college student is supposed to look a certain way or act a certain way or come from a privileged background. And I think we just represent that it doesn't matter where you come from. It don't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter what your background is. If you can write papers, if you're a good reader, you're attentive, you think critically, you think analytically, you will do great in higher education. So I don't think anybody should ever limit their abilities or be insecure about who they are on a college campus. If you love higher education, you love to learn, and you love to be a good person, you can thrive here, and we are a prime example.
Thank you for listening to the My Turn Conversation podcast. My Turn is a community-based, university-accredited program providing education, mentorship, and career development support to and by those who have been directly impacted by the criminal legal system. My Turn's objective is to provide an opportunity for each participant to reframe their skills, interests, responsibilities, and commitments. Support these students by visiting tupit.org and donating. TUPIT.org. Music brought to you by Elmer Platez and Burnell Jones II.
That was from the My Turn Conversation podcast series. It's called Trenches to Tufts, and it's from season 5.
And as you heard at the end of that program, you can learn more about Tupit and the My Turn program and ways that you can support this work at tupit.org. That's TUPIT.org. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. Before we leave, we have a quick plug for an upcoming workshop that we're hosting at the Design Studio. On Tuesday, April 28th, we're having a brain break during reading period. And that workshop is going to be Building Your Own Speaker. It's a collaboration with Kelsey Rogers from the Music Engineering Department and CEEO. And come hang out with us. Kim, you got anything you want to talk about?
Just super thanks again to Emma, our star student, for making this podcast broadcast possible. And thanks to you all for listening. And come stop by, visit us, third floor, Tisch Library. Come say hi.
Should we do it
again? Yeah, we're going to do it again. Okay. Here we go. Ready?
This is Emma.
I'm Miles.
And Kim.
And you are listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford Tufts Freeform Radio.
Esto es África. Samina, mira.